I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Michael Freund, founder and chairman of Shavai Israel, bringing the lost tribes of Israel back home. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinchinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Maven on Israel, Inbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom, Lashana Tova and Gemara Chatima Tova. It's a new Jewish year, just 7 days old, which means we are in the midst of the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, the 10 days of repentance, from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, from the Day of Judgment to the conclusion of the appeal process on the Day of Atonement. This Jewish season is always a time of exaltation. That's why they call them the High Holy Days in our tradition, but there's also a certain sense of pressure. We're in the midst of these 10 days when we try to right the wrongs we've done over the past year and reconcile with anyone we've injured or offended. It's a challenge to heal our actions from the past 12 months. It is perhaps a greater challenge to try to change the habits we've fallen into that lead us to do things we're not proud of. Our goal during these days of awe is to look honestly at ourselves, to ask God to forgive us those failings we've committed over the past year, and so to again become whole. But as the Talmud tells us, for sins against God, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, atones, but for sins against other human beings, the Day of Atonement does not atone until we've made atonement to them personally. God cannot heal the breaches in our relationships. Only we can do that by going to the people we've wronged and asking them to forgive us. So this is the most important time of year for us morally, a crucial period of reflection, self-examination, and what Israelis call cheshbon hanefesh, taking an accounting of our souls. On Yom Kippur, the fast day of atonement, holiest day of the entire Jewish year, which begins at sundown this Tuesday, we commit ourselves to trying to repair our own world through repentance, prayer, and charity, teshuvah, tefillah, utzidakah. The melody that captures the essence of Yom Kippur best is also the only melody that people come to temple just to hear. The Kol Nidre, the renunciation of failed vows, begins the night of Yom Kippur. It's the melody that for many people captures the heart of the Jewish experience in just a few minutes of music. Here's the great cantor Moshe Oysher's rendition of the opening sections of the Kol Nidre. That was the remarkable Moshe Oysher's Kol Nidre for Yom Kippur, coming up Tuesday night. Kol Nidre is designed to bring us close to what is holiest within us. And at this time of atonement and return, we do well to remember that holiness begins for Jews with personal actions, mitzvot, not simply words or professions of faith. The way to improve the world is by doing acts of goodness, blessing, and courage, not by talking about them, not even with God. That's what we dedicate ourselves to this week, actions that matter and improve the world. Nonetheless, we do need to ask God for help. And that's never more clear than in the Kol Nidre's soaring conclusion. Here's cantor and opera star Jan Pierce singing the end of the Kol Nidre. You know, we could do a whole show on the melody of Kol Nidre, its many interpretations. We could tell famous stories about Kol Nidre Eve, jokes about Kol Nidre, and so on. But the truth is, the only way to truly appreciate Kol Nidre is to hear it live, in synagogue, this Tuesday night, the eve of Yom Kippur, in a room filled with fervent prayer, soaring music, white clothing and tallises, prayer shawls, and the power of the great Day of Atonement. It's a truly amazing experience, and it takes place just one night a year, this coming Tuesday night at a synagogue near you. Join me at Congregation Beit Simcha, 6 p.m. this Tuesday night. And all of it, the Kol Nidre, the music, the drama, it's there to bring us to tshuva, repentance, to help us learn how to work to heal injustice and brokenness, both in our own lives and in the world. Our guest this morning, Michael Freund, has created an organization in Jerusalem and around the world that seeks to bring isolated Jewish communities back into the fold. Find out what his organization is and where they are doing their best work when he joins us in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Michael Freund is the founder and chairman of Shavei Yisrael, the organization that seeks and assists Jewish communities and Jews around the world who are kind of returning to Jewish identity and experience. He previously served in Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu the first time around as a deputy communications director, and then has had a number of other professional experiences. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thanks, Brother Sam. It's good to be with you.
Tell me a little bit about the origin of Shavei Yisrael.
Well, I was born and raised in New York, and I made Aliyah in 1995. I moved to Israel, and in 1996, when Benjamin Netanyahu was elected prime minister the first time around, I went to work for him in the prime minister's office. And one day in the spring of 1997, a small crumpled orange envelope arrived addressed to the prime minister from a community in northeastern India known as the B'nai Menashe, who claimed to be descendants of one of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. That letter happened to cross my desk, and I read it. And initially, I thought it was completely nuts, to be honest. There was something about it that was so sincere and heartfelt that I chose to answer it. And it later turned out that the book, the Maimon HaSheh, had been writing to Israeli Prime Minister since at least Golda Meir in the early 70s, probably since David Ben-Gurion and the founding of the state in 1948, asking to be allowed to come back to the land of their ancestors, but they'd never received a reply. And when I met with the members of the community and I learned more about their history and their traditions and their customs, I became persuaded that, in fact, they are who they claim to be. They are our lost brethren, and that we have a responsibility towards them. So I became involved through the bureaucracy in arranging for large numbers of them to move to Israel. And in 1999, when Mr. Netanyahu left office, I left the Prime Minister's office as well. And I began reading up about various communities and their Jewish history, such as the Muranos or the Banano Seam of Spain, Portugal, and South America, and the Chinese Jews of Kaifeng. And I simply got on the plane and visited these communities. I saw that communities are still out there. They still exist, still have a sense of historical Jewish consciousness. And I also saw that no one was doing anything to reach out to them. And I thought then, and I still believe today, that that is a strategic mistake on our part. And that's what prompted me to start Shavei Israel, with the goal of extending a hand to these communities that were once part of us. And strengthening our connection with them.
It's a fascinating effort and an interesting story. I think each community is interesting in and of itself. We will talk much more with Michael Freund when we return in a moment and explore some of those communities right here on Two Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and especially Northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this fall. Our very first Yom Kippur is coming up this week. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, both Friday night and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, an entire religious school, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us next Friday night at 7315 North Oracle Road for Shabbat evening services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 o'clock, followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Join us for Shabbat, 7315 North Oracle Road, Congregation Beit Simcha. Now, for our inaugural Yom Kippur services, everyone is welcome. There is no charge to attend Yom Kippur, but pre-registration is essential. Kol Nidrei services are at 6 p.m. Tuesday night. Please call 520-276-5675 to sign up for the High Holy Days at Beit Simcha. Yom Kippur Day services begin with a Taik service at 9 o'clock and general services at 9:30. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school, Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, High School program, and our rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and, of course, Yom Kippur, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675, that's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning, High Holy Days, and much more. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners. with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. You know, we played a couple of outstanding renditions of Kol Nidre in the first part of the show today, but I would be remiss if I omitted my least favorite Kol Nidres of all time. In the mid-20th century, Jews, with a strong connection to their heritage, represented a disproportionate percentage of the record-buying public. Boy, that's a phrase you don't hear anymore. Producing a record that would be interesting to them was important. Perhaps that explains why the sleepiest singer of all time, Italian crooner Perry Como, recorded this rendition of the Kol Nidre. If you think you have trouble staying awake during services, try it when this most dramatic piece of music sounds like this.
Kol Nidre. Vesole ushvue vacharome vekonome vekenose vahi.
Very relaxed, but frankly nowhere near as terrible as the very, very worst Kol Nidre ever recorded. Here is Johnny Mathis, chances are, of all people, warbling his way through the Kol Nidre lost.
Kol Nidre.
Nothing like Johnny Mathis mumbling and sliding and trembling through Kol Nidre, singing vaguely recognizable versions of actual Aramaic words to make you feel introspective or perhaps slightly ill. Like how you feel after fasting for many hours, just a little sick to your stomach. Well, if in spite of my less than stellar recommendation, if you liked listening to that, definitely look up Johnny Mathis' version of Eli Eli on YouTube. Not for the faint of heart, or eardrum, or stomach. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about this larger question about whether religions are big business or big businesses. The one thing we can say for sure is Judaism doesn't have that kind of centralized structure that, say, the Catholic Church does, or even the Mormon, the LDS Church does. and never developed that way. Why do you think that is or was?
Well, as usual with me, I think the answer lies in history. So if we go back to the beginnings, when Jews were first redeemed from slavery in Egypt and settled the Promised Land, they built a temple. They had kings. They also had priests, including a high priest.
Kohanim, by the way.
Right.
My ancestors, in theory.
Right. And so there was this priestly caste that was inherited. It was genetic, passed from father to son. And the priests had to be supported. And there was a system of sacrifices prescribed in the five books of Moses that basically supported and ensured that the priests would have what to eat. So the temple was kind of self-sustaining, and people could make
the tithe system and
right. People could make additional offerings, but there were specific offerings were prescribed, which we don't pay much attention to anymore. In fact, we gloss over these long, interminably boring passages about the oil and the goats and the heifers
and
the bullocks
and the grain. And
right,
the
grain, all that stuff. But the purpose of that was so that the priest didn't have to go out and raise money. And they didn't have to create an imaginary threat of hell or promise of heaven to raise money. Their livelihood was, in a sense, assured by the system of sacrifices prescribed in the five books. So I think that's one difference from the very beginning. And then the question of, so who did the temple belong to? Well, it belonged to all Jews in a way. I mean, it wasn't the property of one person or one family, and there weren't duplicative temples anywhere else. There was one temple. There weren't like suburban temples.
Well, originally, of course, although there probably were initially, and then they were all centralized in Jerusalem. But one other point, which is the priests could not own land, right? They couldn't own flocks and herds. It was against the rules. They didn't have a portion.
Right. But the point was that the whole thing was designed to keep religion, or certainly the temple cult part of religion, and business and fundraising and schnorring separate.
Separate, right.
And they were separate. Now, there were also no, outside the temple in the early days, there was no clergy. I mean, the institution of a rabbi is relatively recent. Didn't really happen until the destruction of the first temple, and Jews were in exile, and they needed people to guide them.
And formally, even later, I mean, less than 2,000 years ago.
So, right, with the destruction
Jewish
of the second temple.
That's not so old.
Right. I mean,
after the destruction, right.
Right. There was some creation of clergy in the wake of the destruction of the first temple.
For sure.
586 BCE. But then, after the destruction of the second temple, which is after the time of Jesus, there was a greater evolution in clergy, and there was a greater dispersion of the Jewish community throughout the Roman Empire. And it's that period where the church, as it was, and Judaism take very different paths, diverging paths. And I think that's what we should look at next week.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Tom. Shana Tova and Gemar Chatima Tova.
And to you.
We welcome our Mivina on Israel, Inbal Shtivi, the director of the Israel Center, and our Shlicha on Israel, Boker Tov and Gemar Chatima Tova.
Boker Tov, Gemar Chatima Tova.
So, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is not only a time of introspection and tshuva, but also Jewish food. Coming from an Ashkenazic background, gefilte fish is just something that you eat, right?
Yeah.
If you're from a Sephardic background, not so much.
Not so much, yeah. So Rosh Hashanah is a great holiday in Israel for us Jewish Israelis.
Right.
It's a very big holiday, actually, if you are invited to a Rosh Hashanah dinner out of town, you will see like so many cars with people, whole families dressed nicely, riding, going on a traffic jam, of course, for 2 hours to get to the holiday, to the evening, to meet other family members and friends. So I kind of miss being home in this time of the year, and not because of the traffic jam so much, but because of my friends and family, of course. So yeah, gefilte fish. Gefilte fish is part of our table as well. I myself belong to the two traditions. Part of my family is Polish Russian, and the other part is Libyan Jew. So we have
that's quite an intermarriage, right? Libyan Jews and Russian Polish Jews. Right?
Yeah, definitely. We have so actually intermarriage mean in this context means that on our Rosh Hashanah table we have both. We have gefilte fish and we have chayme, which is a spicy, more piquant, I would say.
North African.
It's very red and it's tasteful.
It's delicious,
and
by
it's
the way.
Delicious.
But you have to like a little fire.
Yeah, we take it. So for us, kids are we always eat both.
I love that marriage of the two traditions. You know, for a long time in Israel, they used to have this scene in almost every Israeli movie. It seemed like Salach Shabbati or any of those sort of classic Israeli films, old time ones, where the Ashkenazic boy was brought the Sephardic girl to the dinner table, or the other way around, mm-hmm. to the Shabbat table. And it was like the first time she or he had ever tasted gefilte fish, and they'd take one bite and then they'd quietly feed the rest to the cat.
Yeah, and I disagree. I think gefilte fish is wonderful. If you had the chazeret, the horseradish, the red one.
Of course.
And
it's the only way, absolutely.
Yeah, it's just beautiful. It's so tasteful, and it's just has a bad reputation.
Yes,
but
it doesn't deserve it.
It doesn't deserve it, not rightfully.
Also, a good thing to have either before Yom Kippur fast or at the break fast, you know, because it tastes even better when you haven't eaten for 24 hours.
Definitely.
Thanks so much, Inval. Gemar Chatima
Tova. Thank you, Gemar Chatima Tova.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Terrorists burst into a shul just before Yom Kippur begins. They demand $20 million in ransom and a jet plane to escape. The governor, a tough man, says no. The terrorists announce they will kill in quick succession three people. They choose the rabbi, the cantor, and the synagogue president. They tell the rabbi, "We're going to kill you first." Any last requests? "Just one," says the rabbi. "All my life, I wanted to give the perfect sermon. This time for Yom Kippur, I worked on my sermon for months. It's great. It's an hour long. Before you kill me, I'd like to give my sermon." "No problem," says the chief terrorist. "Give your sermon, then we'll kill you." He turns to the cantor. "You'll be second to die then. Any last requests?" "Only one," says the cantor. "All my life, I've wanted to sing the perfect Yom Kippur service. This year I practiced and practiced. I've polished it to perfection. It takes 2 hours. Before you kill me, I would like to sing it." "No problem," says the terrorist. He then turns to the president. "What is your last request? Any last wish?" "Only one," says the president. "Kill me first." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, here on behalf of the Wine Tribe Israel and Israel in general. Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, Boker Tov and Gemar Chatima Tova.
Gemar Chatima Tova.
So Yom Kippur is coming up. We talked about Rosh Hashanah and sort of what it means to be Chilonim, quote-unquote secular Jews in Israel, which sometimes involves a lot of Jewish stuff. Shabbat dinner every Friday night. Yom Kippur is the holiest day of the year in Judaism. For religious Jews, the most important day of the year. But interestingly, in America, if you're not religious, you don't go to synagogue, you might not even go to synagogue Yom Kippur, the holiest day. Israelis see it differently, don't they?
Actually, for me, I fast in Yom Kippur. My mom does fast. But we have something like a traditional in Israel. Tradition, like people I see in my neighborhood, small kids go ride bicycles. Okay, and for my parents, it's weird. For why do they do that?
Why don't they just drive?
Yeah,
right?
yeah, not like that. But yeah, we feel that also as we feel in most of holidays, we feel the spiritual thing about Yom Kippur, and you know, the
atonement,
Tashlich, and all of the tradition things that we do. Yeah, so again, you don't have to be, you don't have to make that effort to be a Jewish and to focus
it's
on.
It's part of the whole culture.
Sure, sure.
It always seems to me that Israelis, even very secular Israelis, many of them will fast on Yom Kippur and do what they call a cheshbon ha-nefesh, take an accounting of their soul, whether they go to the synagogue or not. Many will go, of course, but that they'll sit down and say, you know, what was my year like? What do I want it to be next year? Danielle, what did you guys do? I mean, the moshav is a different kind of setting than a city, right?
So in the moshav, you could imagine like a huge room, and then Yom Kippur, you just close the door to the room, and it's just everyone who is in the moshav is just there. So, you know, you step out of your house and you see everyone in the moshav playing in the playground, and you see like everyone, and that's the beautiful thing about the moshav, that you know everyone. So if it's kids that I used to babysit like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I'm just seeing everyone, and like the old kid, like the old people say, how you've grown. Like, and that's when I started to see it, when I was starting to see the small kids. And
it's kind of like a congregation, to
yes,
be totally
absolutely
honest.
It was totally like that, because at that day everyone would fast, and not even for like the actual meaning of it, but just like for the experience to mm-hmm. like see what it is. And we used to, none of my friends would use their phones. We just like in old times go to the actual house and knock on the door and ask for that friend to come out and play outside, and we would play board games until the end of like late of nights. And that's actually the like best days in Moshav, because it's just like all about being at home with
community,
the people you
in
care.
Community.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And how, did everybody fast?
Most of the people, like. Huh. Let's say like 85%, something like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure 85% of the people in synagogues fast.
That's, I don't think so. But the thing is, on that day,
at least in America, I can't speak to Israel on this question.
Yeah. So on that day, our improvised synagogue is opening.
Right.
Yes. So
that day you have a shul.
That day
you have a baked
nesset. Right. So it's a small room with chairs that don't fit in.
Right.
And a Torah.
You squish in, and,
yes,
and a Torah. And
we improvise a chazan, and it's all fun.
It's nice. Everybody's part of it. Listen, I hope you have a tzom kal, an easy fast, and gemar chatima tova.
Thank you so
much. And now a word of Torah. This week, we read the next to last portion of the entire Torah reading cycle, Ha'azinu, penultimate section of the final book of the Torah, Deuteronomy. Ha'azinu is composed of Moses' last poetic words to the people of Israel before his death. It's an elaborate instruction, a charge, a prediction of the future for the Israelites. Ha'azinu is both a final look inside the thoughts of the greatest leader our people has ever had, and a fascinating snapshot of what was predicted for the future of the 12 tribes once they arrived in the land of Israel. Ha'azinu is a longish poem, and the powerful poetry includes a description of God's word dropping like a gentle rain on tender grass, and a vision of the Lord's justice and faith as complete and flawless. It describes God's love for Israel, bringing forth honey from the very rock to nourish and favor our people. In language rich and complex, but also challenging, Moses promises that God brings reward to those who preserve justice, but punishes those who fail to keep faith with God. In one memorable phrase that has made its way into the prayer book, Moses says, "Ki shem Adonai ekra havu godel Eloheinu," I will proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribing greatness to our God. Accordingly, our role is to both praise God and to create justice in this world. Both are important. Both support each other. We praise God and acknowledge that justice comes from the one source of morality. And then we work to assure that justice for all is central to our moral life. We must strive not only to be good, but to create goodness in our world. May you be sealed in the book of life for a good year, a gemara chatima tova, a just year, and a tzom kal, an easy fast on Yom Kippur. Our guest this morning, Michael Freund, is the founder, chairman, and driving force behind an organization, Shavei Israel, that seeks and finds Jewish communities and connects them in dramatic and meaningful ways to the people of Israel. Find out how they manage to do this and which communities are most active right now when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In our Not the Ideal Way to Begin the New Jewish Year, Senator Bernie Sanders had two stents inserted for an artery blockage last week. Jeff Weaver, an aide to the Vermont Democrat and presidential hopeful, said Sanders had experienced some chest discomfort at a campaign event early in the week, possibly on Monday on Rosh Hashanah. Obviously, he wasn't in shul. Testing found the arterial blockage and the procedure was successfully completed. Senator Sanders is conversing and in good spirits. He'll be resting up over the next few days, his spokesman said. The Jewish lawmakers' campaign events have been canceled until further notice. Sanders, 78 years old, currently is polling third in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination behind Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden. Over 130,000 Jews of Sephardic heritage applied for Spanish citizenship under a 2015 law giving the right to naturalization to descendants of Sephardic Jews. The application window for the Spanish Law of Return expired on Rosh Hashanah at the end of September. More than half the applications were filed last month, most of them coming from Latin American countries. Under the law, descendants of Sephardic Jews may become citizens if their application is approved for lineage by the umbrella group of Spanish Jewish communities and the Justice Ministry. As of the beginning of September, Spain had naturalized about 8,300 applicants under the law. Obviously, many more await processing. In both Spain and Portugal, which passed a similar but still open-ended law shortly before Spain did, the Sephardic naturalization laws were described as aimed at atoning for the state-led campaigns of persecution against Jews in the 15th century and 16th century, the Spanish and Portuguese Inquisitions, and, of course, the massive official expulsion of all Jews from Spain in 1492 and Portugal in 1496. In other news, the German city of Aachen nixed an award to a Lebanon-born artist after discovering that he is a supporter of the Boycott Israel movement. Waleed Rad will not get the Aachen Art Prize due to his political views, the mayor said. The prestigious prize comes with an award of approximately $11,000. According to research, we have to assume that the designated prize winner is a supporter of the BDS movement and has been involved in various measures for the cultural boycott of Israel, said Mayor Marcel Philippe. The statement said the contemporary media artist had been asked about his support for the BDS movement against Israel, and his reply had been evasive. Rod currently lives in New York. He teaches at Cooper Union, the School of Art there. In May, Germany passed a resolution calling the BDS movement anti-Semitic, the first major European parliament to do so. In 2014, Rod signed a letter calling on artists to withdraw from an exhibition because it was being shown at Israel's Technion Institute of Technology. More than 100 artists and intellectuals signed the letter organized by the BDS Arts Coalition. Last month, the German city of Dortmund withdrew a literary award to British author Kamala Shamsi for her support of the Boycott Israel movement. And a federal judge in New York has ordered billionaire casino magnate Sheldon Adelson to pay compensatory damages and legal fees to the National Jewish Democratic Council for using, quote, unquote, legal sadism to disband the organization. The National Jewish Democratic Council exists primarily in name only as it works to recover its debts from its legal battle with Sheldon Adelson that began in 2012. In his ruling last week, U.S. District Judge Paul Oetken said that Adelson has failed to demonstrate that his initial lawsuit was a good faith communication. Adelson sued the National Jewish Democratic Council in 2012 over an online petition alleging that the major Republican donor allowed prostitution at his casino in Macau. The petition included a hyperlink to an AP article carrying allegations against Adelson. Much of the legal argument was over whether attaching a hyperlink is a clear enough signal that the defendants were citing available information. The hyperlink was embedded in an online petition urging Republicans not to take money from Adelson, who, in addition to being a major giver to the Republican Party, also funds Jewish, pro-Israel, and medical philanthropies. The linked AP article reported on a lawsuit by a former employee of Adelson alleging that that employee was terminated for refusing to allow prostitutes to ply their trade at the Macau casino. National Jewish Democratic Council attorney Richard Emery said that he plans to depose Sheldon Adelson October 15th in Las Vegas, where the lawsuit was filed. The group is seeking damages under a statute in Nevada that penalizes frivolous lawsuits, in part about 12 other cases in which Adelson sued parties hoping to destroy them economically to establish a pattern of legal behavior. The National Jewish Democratic Council and former chairman Mark Stanley are seeking $24 million in punitive damages. Adelson, of course, is also a major financial backer of President Trump. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Michael Freund is the founder and chairman of Shave Israel, the organization that assists distant and we can even say kind of remote Jewish communities, communities that have retained a Jewish identity to return to the peoplehood of Israel. He served, as we heard earlier in the show, as a deputy communications director for Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu when he was just 28 years old. Subsequently went on to work in this particular area, trying to connect Jewish communities all over the world back to Judaism. He has received a number of awards. He has personally an MBA finance from Columbia and a BA from the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Affairs at Princeton, has written books about Do You Have Jewish Roots?, and continues to reach out to assist these communities. So you started with the B'nai Menashe and then explored the Anusim. The B'nai Menashe, how many of them have come to Israel? Obviously, that there's been a real transformation in the way that Israel has accepted some of these communities and has reached out to help them. What percentage of them have come to Israel? How has that worked out?
Over the past few decades, we've been blessed to bring more than 4,000 members of the B'nai Menashe on Aliyah. My organization has received permission to bring another 700 over the coming year. And there are still another 6,500 in India waiting to come. They all wish to do so. And we are determined to do everything we can to ensure that every last member of the B'nai Menashe who wants to make Aliyah will be able to do so. And I should point out that the B'nai Menashe they all speak English. They all have at least a high school education. They're all walking around with smartphones and following the news in Israel. And so their absorption here in the country, in the Jewish state, has been quite successful as a result. Everyone who meets them loves them. They are just warm, kind, loving people. And I think they are a blessing for Israel and the Jewish people.
You spoke about the Anusim, the B'nai Anusim, the hidden Jews, secret Jews of Spain and Portugal. The B'nai Menashe community dates its heritage back to the destruction of the first temple, 2,600 years ago. The B'nai Anusim, that's a much more recent phenomenon, but still something like 500 years and more since the expulsions of 1492, 1496 from Portugal. What are the issues facing the B'nai Anusim? How do they differ from the kinds of experiences we think of with Jews creating their own identities in other parts of the world?
Well, we know that in the Middle Ages, Spain was home to the largest Jewish community in the world at the time. And beginning in the year 1391, were a series of pogroms and forced conversions and massacres. And those were followed by various eras of persecution over the subsequent century, all of which culminated with the expulsion of Spanish Jewry in 1492. And that was followed 5 years later by the forcible conversion of the bulk of Portuguese Jewry. What many people don't realize, though, is that whereas the Jews were, in fact, expelled from Spain those who had been forcibly converted were not allowed to leave. And many of them, at great risk to themselves and their families, continued to practice Judaism in secret, even though the long arm of the Spanish Inquisition was ruthlessly hunting them down, seeking to stamp out any attempts at maintaining a covert life. With the passage of time, when Spain and Portugal, wherever they planted their colonial flags around the world, these conversos, or Muranos, as historians have referred to them, were always among the first to make their way to the colonies because they wanted to get as far as possible from the Inquisition. Didn't help because the Inquisition, in their zealotry, literally followed the Anseme around the globe, hunting them down. But nowadays, in recent years especially, we're seeing a growing number of people around the Spanish and Portuguese-speaking world who are discovering or rediscovering their Jewish roots. You've probably heard the stories about people who have a grandparent, a grandmother, who every Friday afternoon would go to the basement or the attic and light two candles.
You know, close the shutters first, make sure that nobody could see in. Everybody's heard that story, I think.
And those are real. Those are, this is happening. There are still traces or customs or memories that were preserved. And now a growing number of the descendants of those forcibly converted Jews are knocking on our collective door and are looking to be, they'll be allowed back in. And I think we have, we the Jewish people, we have a moral responsibility, a historical responsibility, and even a religious responsibility to open the door and to facilitate their return.
We should
remember that they were taken from us, their ancestors were taken from us against their will. They were essentially kidnapped from us. And if we now have an opportunity to help some of their descendants turn to our people, then I don't think we can turn a blind eye to this.
Tell us how Shavé Israel works with groups in a variety of countries, in places like Africa. Explain a little bit about how you guys do what you do.
Well, it varies from community to community, of course. In some places, such as in Central and South America, we have emissaries who we send to work with the various communities. We have full-time emissaries in countries such as Colombia and Chile, elsewhere. In other places, we will periodically carry out various activities such as seminars or conferences where we try to provide the community with various Jewish educational resources so that they can strengthen themselves in their and deepen their knowledge and understanding of Judaism. I should stress that Judaism, of course, is not a missionizing religion, so to speak, or a proselytizing religion, I should say. So our goal is not to put a yarmulke on everyone's head. It's much broader than that. We want people who have a sense or a connection to Jewishness to celebrate that sense and connection and deepen it as they understand it. So there are communities we work with, such as the B'nai Menashe of India, who want to make Aliyah and formally return to the Jewish people, so we facilitate that. On the other hand, there are plenty of Neanusim or Muranos who are not necessarily interested in organized religion or in emigrating to Israel. They simply have an intellectual or emotional curiosity. What does it mean that their ancestors were once Jews? So we try to help them as well, each person in their own way.
You know, I was in China not too long ago, And the Kaifeng community is one that you've had contact with, but the official attitude of the government there must make that somewhat challenging at times.
Yes. We have brought almost 24 young Chinese Jews on Aliyah over the past decade. And for the past 5 years now, the Chinese government has been cracking down on the Jewish community in Kaifeng. The Chinese Jews there, I should mention, are descendants of Sephardic Jews who traveled along the Silk Route in the 7th or 8th century from Persia or Iraq and settled in the city of Kaifeng, which was one of the capitals of Imperial China at the time, with the blessing of the emperor. There was a Jewish community there for well over 1,000 years, and in the past 2 centuries, to assimilation and intermarriage, the community essentially ceased to exist. But until today, there are up to 1,000 people in Kaifeng who look Chinese, who speak Chinese, and who are identifiable via family trees as descendants of Chinese Jewish community. And in recent years, a growing number, particularly of the young people, have begun to express an interest in learning more about the heritage of their forefathers. And we've been trying to facilitate that. But as I mentioned, the communist regime in recent years has been cracking down on various religions in the country, including the Jews in Kaifeng. They prohibit them from gathering together on the Sabbath or on festivals. And 2 years ago, the Chinese police went house to house in Kaifeng, forced the Jewish descendants to take down the mezuzot on their doorposts. Mm. So we are unable to operate in Kaifeng because of the restrictions in place. But we continue in various ways to try and strengthen the community members who are still there. And we hope to bring another group, the young Chinese Jews, on Aliyah in the near future.
I want to thank Michael Freund for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Your website is shavei.org, shavei.org. What can people do to assist you in your work?
Well, we rely on donations from individuals and organizations, so that's certainly something that people can do to help us if they believe in our mission.
It's a great message.
So your listeners to check out our website and learn more about these fascinating communities.
It's very, really fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and have a Shana Tova, a happy and healthy new year.
You too. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Professor Dov Weiss on his National Jewish Book Award-winning work, Pious Irreverence, Confronting God in Rabbinic Judaism. He's a great guy. Our playout this morning comes from Mordechai Ben David, his version of Barosh Hashanah Uv'Yom Tzom Kippur. Join us for Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, at my own congregation, Beit Simcha, if you're in Tucson or Southern Arizona. Yom Kippur arrives this Tuesday night and Wednesday, October 8th and 9th. Call 520-276-5675 to make reservations. No payment is required, although totally voluntary donations are certainly appreciated. That is, it's free, but you must pre-register. 520-276-5675 to attend the Jewish High Holy Days at Congregation Beit Simcha. My friends, may you receive a Gemara Chatima Tova. May you be sealed for a good year in the Book of Life. Have a Tzom Kal, an easy fast, and a week and a year, we pray, of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.